On Tuesday, April 23rd at 6 p.m., the DSR Network and the New Republic will be co-hosting an evening featuring a conversation with Secretary of Transportation Pete Buttigieg. The event will take place at the National Press Club. If you are a member and live or will be in the D.C. area and would like to attend, please email Riley Fessler at rmfessler@trgmedia.com. That's rmfessler@trgmedia.com. We have a few seats still available and would love to see you there.
Hi, this is Riley Fessler, producer for the DSR Network. Today's episode, From the Silo, is a Words Matter from June of last year, where David Rothkopf joins Norm Ornstein to vent about Trump's arraignment and the cases to come. We hope you enjoy.
This is Words Matter with Norm Ornstein.
We've got the votes and screw the rest of you.
And Dr. Kavita Patel.
These might be some of the smaller moments, you know, with all the bombshells didn't catch people's eyes.
Hello and welcome to Words Matter. I am not Dr. Kavita Patel. She's away this week, so I, David Rothkopf, am standing in for her, although I know I will do an inferior job. Fortunately, for all of you who are Words Matter fans, Norm Ornstein is with us, and he will restore normalcy to the podcast. How are you, Norm?
I am okay, David, and it's a delight to have you, even if you're not Kavita.
Thank you. I will never, ever be as good as Kavita Patel at anything. I've been noticing, Norm, this week, a lot of your tweets. You have been on the warpath. Perhaps it is the Trump arraignment. Has gotten under your skin. And I've just noticed you, every time a Republican does something stupid, you will tweet, "You're a disgrace, delete your account."
More frequently, it is when somebody utters a falsehood about the Trump indictment or makes the false equivalence of Trump to Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, or Joe Biden. I tweet
or read the Jesus. Indictment. Sometimes to Jesus.
Sometimes to Jesus. Read the indictment and then delete your account. And sometimes I add resign in disgrace. And I have been on the warpath, David, because I'm just infuriated by two things. The first is the level of moral cowardice in the face of this powerful indictment, so powerful that the National Review has said this is deeply serious business, and that you get all of these Republicans, starting with the Speaker of the House, Kevin McCarthy, and including Marco Rubio, or Little Marco Rubio, or Littler Marco Rubio, and Mike Lee, and Elise Stefanik, and on and on and on, defending him and supporting him. But it's also people like Lindsey and Chuck Grassley deliberately misstating what the Presidential Records Act says, echoing Trump when he says, the Presidential Records Act says, I can do anything I want with any of these documents, when it is exactly the opposite. And for a ranking member, former chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, for the former chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Chuck Grassley, to say he hasn't read the indictment because he's not a legal scholar, just drives me up a wall. And once again, then there's Mitch McConnell, who refuses to say anything. Every time there's an opportunity to curb this sociopathic, narcissistic autocrat. They refuse to do so. And if you look at past statements, Marco Rubio, the ranking member of the Senate Intelligence Committee, saying in the past, you play around with classified documents, that's a direct threat to national security. Now, protecting Trump and lying about it is just hard to take, David. And that when you see a handful of others take a different position, and I was particularly struck by Ken Buck, who is one of the most radical members of the House, a charter member of the Freedom Caucus, but also a former prosecutor, saying not just that these charges are deeply serious, but also that Donald Trump set the standard by saying of Hillary Clinton in 2016, if you can't treat classified materials appropriately, you are not fit for any office, including dog catcher. And Ken Buck saying, apply that standard, Donald Trump is not fit for office. The contrast then with all these other Republicans at the top of their heap, is just nauseating. Twitter is a vehicle to vent. It's getting increasingly difficult, as you know. I was, just looking at the degree of radicalization of Elon Musk, now basically saying that maybe what we should have is the equivalent of the most vicious dictator in ancient Rome, and saying that fact checkers are all corrupt and in the tank and can't be believed. It's getting harder, but it's so cathartic for me to be able to rail against these monstrous people. So I'm going to stick with it for now.
No, it's very cathartic for me for you to rail against these people. But, there has been some silence. I think the Senate Republicans have been distinguished, with a couple of exceptions, by their silence on these issues, except for Romney on the side of the angels, and more or less, and Cruz and Hawley and some particularly Mike Lee nasty ones, carrying Trump's water. But there is one place that the Republicans have actually started to speak out, right? And I find this striking, and I'm interested in your reaction. You have the former White House Chief of Staff, General John Kelly, coming down hard on Trump, saying it's the first time he's being held accountable and saying he's scared shitless. You have the former White House Chief of Staff, Mick Mulvaney, saying something, equally serious about Trump. You have the former Trump Attorney General, Bill Barr, saying that Trump is toast and that he is done as far as this is concerned. You have the former Trump Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, who has essentially been a Trump poodle, saying Trump has violated the law. You have Mike Pence now saying, the former vice president, that Trump did what was on here, it's very serious. And he would not even go so far as to say that he would consider to pardon him if he were elected president, which is a shift from Mike Pence. You have Nikki Haley, the former Trump UN ambassador, coming around and actually offering some criticism. You have John Bolton, who, John Bolton, but nonetheless going at great length to attack Trump for the national security violations here. The entire friggin' Trump cabinet has come out against Trump.
And, my favorite word of the last year has been lickspittle, followed by perfidy. But when you have a lickspittle like Nikki Haley turning against him, you're absolutely right, and other lickspittles that you have mentioned. It is a sign of people who are going to twist and bend in the wind depending on what they see is going to work best for them and their own unbounded ambitions. And that is a sign for many that Trump is going to have bigger troubles ahead. Now, Lindsey Graham yesterday said something else that really set me off, which is a warning that if there are additional indictments involving January 6th, that Republicans would go to DEFCON 1. And here again, you know, all of the stuff surrounding January 6th, all of these lawmakers who knew that potentially they could die on that day because of the Proud Boys and the other radicals coming through, many of them armed, eager to assassinate key members of Congress, now whitewashing all of that is just beyond loathsome. Now, having said all of that, if you're Donald Trump this week, you know, first of all, that 20 of your Secret Service agents who had been on detail with you, who were there through every minute, ended up testifying. And you have no idea which ones would lie for you. And it's unlikely that all of them would. When you have Mark Meadows, who they've nailed to the wall, going in and testifying, and it's very likely that he turned on Donald Trump. You have this set of indictments, and the only thing you got going for you on this, and we know that there's a whole lot more than what was in that 50 plus pages in the indictment that the Justice Department has. The only thing you got going for you is a judge who so far has proven to be a lickspittle to Trump, Aileen Cannon. But you can't be sure how all of this will come out. And you know that it wasn't Joe Biden or even Jack Smith who indicted you. It was two dozen Floridians in a grand jury. So even a jury in southern Florida, you can't be sure what will happen with that. We now know that Bedminster is a target, his New Jersey place. And I think both of us were perplexed that there was no search warrant for Bedminster after we saw these pictures of boxes being loaded onto Trump's plane going from Mar-a-Lago and West Palm Beach to Bedminster. And it now has occurred to me, maybe they did do a search warrant, but unlike the Mar-a-Lago one, when Trump trumpeted that, as he said, it was raided, maybe they did it without anybody knowing about it or trumpeting it. And very possibly they also looked in what would be a likely spot for Trump to bury top secret documents, namely the grave of his wife, Ivana, on the golf course. And since Ivana was cremated, the idea that there's a grave there, it does raise all kinds of questions. You know that Georgia's coming up in August. And for the first time in your life, all of the crimes you've committed that you've gotten away with, you may not get away with them. This has to have been a very bad, bad week for Donald Trump. And now that you see some of your former lickspittles turning on you, it can't be a pleasant experience for him. And for that, I'm grateful.
Well, yeah, and you make a pretty good case that this is going to turn further and further against him. As you know, I wrote a column yesterday in the Daily Beast.
a wonderful column.
In which I said that Donald Trump is hitting his Wile E. Coyote moment, which is to say that, you know, there he is running along for the presidency or to enrich himself or whatever he's doing for this scheme. And he's going to get out there like Wile E. Coyote does, off the cliff, look down and realize the support has evaporated. One of the most telling things, and you've just described a bunch of it, that in this respect was a story I saw from NBC that said that a bunch of Republicans behind the scenes had met, and they were deeply worried about what all these Trump allegations were going to do to the Republican Party. You know, they've been trying to put a good face on it. But as you say, you've got this case. You may have the Bedminster case. I laugh when you talk of the Ivana Trump grave because, you know, it's actually, I mean, it sounds like a Republican conspiracy theory, but it's actually plausible. You've got Fani Willis out there, which has got to make, by the way, Lindsey Graham a little bit nervous since he made some of those phone calls. And you've got, you know, what is potentially the most serious of all of these things, which is a January 6th case where you could put the president at the middle of a plot that has already been described by multiple judges as an insurrection, as a coup attempt in the United States. Andrew Weissman, the former member of the Mueller team, who was also the FBI general counsel, has gone on the record saying he expects Trump to Jack Smith to bring that case. It seems to me it may be that Trump's already out there hanging in the air and he doesn't even know it yet.
No, I think that's absolutely the case. And, you know, I was at the first debate in 2020 in Cleveland, that infamous debate where it was a very small audience because of COVID. We learned much later that Trump actually had tested positive for COVID when he went on that debate stage. We know that his entire family and entourage refused to wear masks, even though that was the rule. But we also know, more importantly, that that's the debate where Trump said of the Proud Boys, stand by and stand up. And these are the Proud Boys who were convicted of seditious conspiracy. So the charges on January 6th, as you say, could be even more serious, especially if there is any documentary evidence of communications leading up to January 6th and on that day between Trump and some of these people who were engaged in seditious conspiracy, which would make him a seditious conspirator. So all of that is there. I do have to, before we move on, bring up another of my hobby horses. Kevin McCarthy, who I continue to believe is the worst Speaker of the House ever, has said, after all of the pictures emerged of these boxes in the shower, in the bathroom at Mar-a-Lago, saying you can lock a bathroom, apparently either lying or not realizing that, yes, you can lock a bathroom from the inside, not the outside. Nobody wants a bathroom door where you're inside doing your business and somebody locks you in. So, of course, what that meant was that the Chinese spies or Russian spies or Saudi spies who were there at Mar-a-Lago could go into the bathroom, lock the door, and go through their boxes, the boxes that were there, without having to worry about anybody barging in on them. So, you know, some of these excuses for him are just lamer than ever. And it is worth noting, as you know, as well as anybody, every government in the world, but especially our adversaries, spend millions, if not billions, trying to dig into the secrets of the United States and find out what we know. And you have people in the embassies, you have others, you use electronic tools. The biggest bargain for spying in American history is for $200,000, you had complete access to anything at Mar-a-Lago. So we know that there were all kinds of people there, and you look at these pictures of boxes that included top secret documents in the bathroom, in the storage area, on the stage in the ballroom, I, you know, said to at one point, we better check, have the FBI check every band that might have played at a wedding reception that was going through the boxes up on the stage. The way in which this was handled, the possibility that we know, knowing as Trump has gone through this, everything is about the grift. It's still, even as he complains, trying to raise money. Of course, we need to check on whether he sold these documents or traded them for something of value. And we know that Jack Smith is also looking into Trump's relationship with the Saudis and the LIV golf tour. So there's a whole lot going on here that we do not yet know, and all of it will hit Trump. And I do think that anything that he tries to get from the Acme company will not save him from going off that cliff and falling into the abyss.
Well, I think you're right. And at the risk of, you know, winding you up a little bit, let me say a couple of things. One, we've worried about Trump and national security stuff since before he was president. You know, when he reached out to the Russians, that was worrisome. When we discovered that Mike Flynn had reached out to the Russians and had ties to the Turks that he shouldn't have, and then lied about it to the FBI and was fired within the first 3 weeks he was in office, we saw that. When Trump had his first meeting in the Oval Office with the Russian foreign minister and the Russian ambassador, and he displayed to them classified material that had been given to us by the Israelis, we knew it. When he said, I want my son-in-law and daughter to have security clearances, and the people who make those judgments said, no, we shouldn't do that, and he overrode them so that they did have it, even though they weren't eligible for it, we knew it. When he started firing people who he thought were going to get into the business of the relationship he had with the Russians, starting with James Comey, we knew it. When he put people like Rick Grenell and Kash Patel and others into leadership positions in the intelligence community so that he could keep a lid on things, we knew it. When he had his bad conversation with Zelensky and went and put that in a safe and started hiding information, when he had the conversation with Vladimir Putin in Helsinki in 2018, took the side of the Russian intelligence over our own intelligence, and then hid the notes of his conversation with Putin, we knew it. And now, in this particular case, we know that in this 50-ish page indictment, that there are only 30 documents, and that the worst secrets he gave out, they can't bring to trial. And so we are not actually hearing about them. We also know that the one instance where he was shown, and maybe two instances, allegedly of referring to classified documents, were in fact at Bedminster, which we don't know whether it's been explored, but we do know that he brought boxes up there. And so there are multiple places where there was exposure. We do know, as you say, that every foreign intelligence service targeted this place. We don't know what the guest list was at Mar-a-Lago. Some of those Saudis may not have been spies. They may have been guests or business partners he was showing off to. And we also have a story that there were 340 foreign nationals who were hired at Mar-a-Lago without security clearance. I'm sorry to wind you up. I could go on in this, but the reality is that this narrow indictment should not be news to us, and almost certainly does not begin to cover the vast swath of national security abuses of Donald Trump.
You've got me wound up all right, because you're absolutely right. One of the people I hope that the FBI has interviewed is the translator who was the only one in the room with Trump when he had conversations with Vladimir Putin, which he refused to have transcribed. I would just love to have that translator tell authorities what those conversations entailed. Now, you also mentioned the son-in-law. We know that MBS, the leader of Saudi Arabia, the man who engineered the brutal slaying of Khashoggi, boasted over and over that he had Jared Kushner in his hip pocket. There are reports that Kushner shared the presidential daily briefing with MBS. And that, of course, also reveals sources and methods. And we know that when Trump was president, there was a unusual disappearance of our assets from different countries, all of which would suggest that there is a real possibility here that Trump, his son-in-law, and perhaps others in his entourage actually gave up not just secrets about how we might war game a conflict with Iran, but basically that hung our own spies out to dry and had them murdered. It's hard to imagine a more treasonous set of actions if those things are true. Now, just to shift a touch, there is a very chilling story in the New York Times today about Trump's threat that he would pick a prosecutor to go after his adversaries if he were elected again as president, all about Trump taking the Justice Department and completely weaponizing it and knowing that he has people who would do whatever he wanted, like Jeffrey Clark, like Rick Grenell. But also mentioned in that piece is that Ron DeSantis would do the same thing. Take a Justice Department, which has traditionally operated independently of the president, where you're not going to have a police state where the political leaders decide to weaponize prosecutions. And in this case, what we know is that Joe Biden stayed as far away from Merrick Garland and the Justice Department as he could. Merrick Garland bent over doubly, triply, quadruply backwards to try and make sure that there was no hint of the banana republic, we're going to punish our political enemies. And one of the things that he did that he could be criticized for was he let the statute of limitations run out on all of the allegations in the Mueller report before turning to these things and taking a lot of time before moving to prosecutions, all of which is to try and make sure that this was done as independently and appropriately as possible. We would genuinely have a police state if either Donald Trump or Ron DeSantis were elected. We've seen what DeSantis has done, firing inappropriately elected prosecutors in Florida, going after the Disney Corporation. Imagine if he had the Justice Department and police and the military at his disposal to go after his adversaries. We're in a position, in a place now, which I believe is different from anything that we have ever seen before. The possibility, the two main Republican candidates for president would turn the U.S. into a police state and probably have a lot of judges who would let them get away with it. It is an existential moment in America, and that's another reason why I've been venting so much in whatever social media or other media I can use.
And right here on Words Matter, your podcast. You know, if Kavita Patel were here, I know that what she would say at this point is, this is the time that we have to take a break and say goodbye to the non-subscribing members of the audience. If you are a member, then you get to hear the rest of this podcast Stand by, and we'll be back in one moment. So, Norm, you know, I feel a kind of a social obligation to the people you live with and encounter on a daily basis to bring you down off the ledge a little bit. So let me talk about one set of things which I have seen, which is a source of some encouragement. And by the way, I do think that the number of people starting to speak out against Trump is a source of encouragement. But as you say, DeSantis poses a threat. I think Glenn Youngkin and some of the other Republicans would carry forward what are essentially mainstream Republican policies right now that are assaults on democracy, whether it's book banning or constricting the rights of women or constricting the rights of LGBTQ people or promoting insane gun laws. Seeking to constrain voting rights in serious ways. I think the whole party represents that threat. But what's interesting to me is the following. In poll after poll after poll, if you look at judgment about Trump, judgment about the national security violations of Trump, and a whole host of other bit broader policy issues, what you see is, Republicans generally taking the wrong side in these issues. But that's registered Republicans who represent 25% to 30% of the electorate. The rest of the electorate are independents and Democrats. And among independents and Democrats, on the issue of Trump, on the issue of his violations, on the issue of guns, on the issue of abortion, on the issue of climate, on the issue of healthcare, on the issue of education, you have roughly 2/3 of the American electorate opposed to them, which means, yeah, Trump might be able to win the nomination. I don't think he will. DeSantis or somebody else who represents a threat might be able to win it. But it sure does look like they're heading for a drubbing in 2024 when you see the unanimity among Democrats and independents against Trump and Trumpy and MAGA positions.
I do think if Trump is the nominee, and probably if DeSantis is the nominee, that it puts Joe Biden in a more commanding position. But it still leaves me very nervous. If things don't go well in the economy, in the globe, the normal desire to basically just throw the ins out, given also the reality of the distortions of the Electoral College, which means that if a Trump or a DeSantis gets 46 or 47% of the vote, they could still win the presidency. Combined with the continuing efforts to distort outcomes in a presidential election in states where Republican forces could at least create enough uncertainty about the electoral votes that they could deny a 270 majority and send it to the House, where there are still likely to be more state delegations because they vote by state among Republicans. I'm not confident, David. And the other thing is, I think you make a very solid point. More and more Republicans are seeing that identifying their party as the Trump party is a loser for them. So they want to find a way to erase Trump without suffering the backlash of all of the Trump supporters saying that they have betrayed their cult leader. But Trumpism is the dominant force of the Republican Party. You know, Lindsey Graham yet again said yesterday that conservatism is alive and well under Donald Trump. And my response to that is, that's if you want to define conservatism as grifting, kakistocracy, corruption to the core, cuddling up to the worst and most vicious dictators in the world, and creating an autocratic police state. Even if there's no Trump, and even if there's no DeSantis, we're still going to end up with a Republican Party. When I look at the states, I look at the next generation of Republicans coming forward. They're more batshit crazy than the Freedom Caucus. So we've got a continuing big problem in this country. Yesterday, one of the worst and most corrupt members of the House, Luna, brought a censure resolution against Adam Schiff, which failed because 20 Republicans did not join with it. She said she's coming back again. One where, you know, censure is the second toughest punishment that the House can do against its own members. The first is expulsion. She wanted to have him pay a $16 million fine besides being censured, which meant you stand in the well of the House with all of your colleagues around you while the allegations are read against you. For what reason? Because Adam Schiff led the impeachment against Donald Trump, because he said accurately that Trump was in league with the Russians in the 2016 election. And if you look at Luna, she's milquetoast compared to some of the people coming forward in the states, where they are banning books, going after the LGBT community and the trans community, trying to keep them from getting any health care, saying that a 10-year-old who was raped by her father ought to still carry the fetus to term, who are allowing women who want children, who have pregnancies that have gone awry, have to go through operations that mean that they will be childless for the rest of their lives. This is what we have to look forward to. So I'm now the bearer of bad news, even as you try and put it in a slightly better light. And there are some better things out there, you're right. But none of us should lose sight of or be blind to the deep challenges this country faces, even if Donald Trump were to disappear and move to a dacha outside Moscow or a mansion near Riyadh and leave us to our own devices. There's still too many really bad people there and a culture that is a corrosive and corrupt one of one of our two major parties. Have a nice day, David.
Well, we still got 3 or 4 minutes to go. First of all, I would like to say that I do not believe that the prospect of Donald Trump fleeing the country is a zero chance possibility. At some point along the way, he's got to realize what's out there. And I just don't think he has any particular attachment to the United States. Secondly, I think you make a great point, which maybe should be the title of this episode, which is conservatism is to the MAGA GOP as socialism was to Hitler's National Socialist Party. It has nothing to do with it. Now, having said that, I tried to talk you off the ledge. You have now got me on the ledge with you. So I'm just going to give in, and I'm going to bring up one other thing that I think is important for your reaction. And that is that the voters may reject all this in 2024, but MAGA is not dead. This crazed right-wing movement is not dead until the donors stop giving money for it. And the reality is this, that there have emerged a bunch of right-wing donors, whether it's Harlan Crow or Peter Thiel, people of the Elon Musk variety, who are saying, yeah, I'll write a check for book banning. Yeah, I'll write a check for stripping away women's rights. Yeah, I'll write a check for this or that or anything, provided you cut my taxes. Let's vote for... You know, let's enshrine racism in the Constitution, so long as I have more money. And it's kind of an extraordinary phenomenon. And because they are rich and because they are unknown to most people, I fear that they may go on doing this for a long time to come.
You're absolutely right. And we should mention at least one other danger out there, which is related, which is no labels. We now know that No Labels was funneling some money to a radical organization supporting radical right-wing causes. I was reminded this morning that No Labels slammed the January 6th investigation as divisive. And if there is a No Labels candidate for president, given that they have raised at least $70 million, and we don't know exactly who the donors are, but it is very likely that it's some of those billionaires you mentioned. Knowing that while independents and Democrats have decried what's happened to the Republican Party, Joe Biden is going to need some of those suburban Republicans who are appalled by what they're seeing to vote for a Democrat, even though that's tough for them to do. And if there's an alternative, a Joe Manchin, say, on the ballot in critical states, ones like Arizona and Georgia and Wisconsin, where the margin of victory for Biden in 2020 was fairly small, we can go back to the impact that Jill Stein had in states like Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin in denying Hillary Clinton a victory that she likely otherwise would have had. So there are other pernicious forces out there that could make our lives more complicated. And it's striking to me as well, we haven't mentioned one other interesting phenomenon, and that's the Robert F. Kennedy Jr. candidacy. Oh, Kennedy is capturing in some surveys 20% or more of support from Democrats. Now, I believe the vast bulk of that is people who have no real idea what he stands for. It's just the name. It's Robert F. Kennedy Jr. But we know that he is not only an anti-vaxxer, and if he ever somehow became president, we would have mayhem around the country because he would probably block mandatory vaccinations for measles, whooping cough, tetanus, polio, and of course the next pandemic would make it even worse. But he's also now embraced wacko conspiracy theories, including ones that the Russians spread about who killed JFK and what happened to his father. And yet we know that billionaires like David Sachs, like the former head of Twitter, are supporting him and will give him large sums of money. I expect Elon Musk will join that crowd before too long. And it's a measure of how far off base our culture has become and how willing billionaires will be to send us to an autocracy so that they can have unfettered access, not just to their own money, but to whatever reckless policies they want to pursue in their businesses or their hedge funds.
You know, I have a few gray hairs. Some salt and pepper. Well, okay. No, I have mostly gray hairs. So I know some things, and one of them is, there are so many shitheads who are billionaires.
Yeah.
That it's probably fair to draw the conclusion that being a shithead is a prerequisite or makes it easier to become a billionaire. It doesn't mean all the billionaires are shitheads.
No, I mean, I know a couple who are among the best people I know, who put their money where their mouths are, who do good things, but I have to agree that they are very likely the exception rather than the rule.
Yeah. Well,
and
yes,
You know, the foreign minister of Canada, Chrystia Freeland, before she moved back, was a correspondent for Reuters here in Washington. And she wrote a book about these billionaires that was quite powerful. And of course, it was all about how many of them view themselves as victims. And that what Mitt Romney said candidly when he ran for president in 2012 about the makers and the takers was coming right from those billionaires. They have a view of the world that they're the ones who are saving society, even as they do for especially the financial ones, the hedge fund people, nothing to promote anything productive in the society. It's manipulating money to make money. And they're increasingly feeling themselves as victims, willing to go to any lengths to protect themselves. And that is not a good thing.
Well, I'll tell you something. When Chrystia Freeland wrote that book, it was a couple of years after another book had appeared called Superclass, which was about the 6,000 richest and most powerful people in the world. I wrote that book. And so I was like kind of bummed out that Chrystia Freeland had written this book. And for a number of years, I thought, dang, Chrystia Freeland, I was there first. But she was much more accurate in her depiction of the flaws of the superclass than I was. I got it right to some extent. But they're a more dangerous group than I think either of us realized at the time. And certainly that danger is manifest now. So, Norm, I think I'm gonna use my prerogative as the CEO of the DSR Network to change my title suggestion to check your blood pressure before you listen to this episode. But because I think it may work some people up. But that's why we're here. One of the reasons you have this podcast is you are a great truth teller. And I find it super therapeutic. I used to find it therapeutic every week to be able to talk to you in Kavita. But I'm glad I got this chance. So thanks a lot. And thanks to everybody for listening. And keep coming back right here to Words Matter and to the other podcasts on the DSR Network for more. For now, bye-bye.